It's Friday, April 7th, 2017. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. This week in Trumplandia, the big news of the day, of course, is that last night, the U.S. military attacked a Syrian military base with 59 Tomahawk missiles. The attack was a response to the Assad regime's brutal chemical weapons attack in Khan Shaykhun, a town between Damascus and Aleppo that is held by forces opposed to Assad. Trump has not hesitated to order the use of military force since he took office, of course, as we saw out there in Yemen, ramping things up in Iraq. And awed by the first pictures of the Tomahawk missile attacks being launched from U.S. destroyers, MSNBC's Brian Williams calls the pictures beautiful. No doubt that the airstrikes will dominate the news, even as the Senate moves to approve Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court today. In order to break a Democratic Party filibuster, the Senate Republicans changed the Senate rules. The repeal of the 20th century is now officially on the menu. Bannon versus Jared, a.k.a. the tramp versus the cuck. Jared does Iraq. Don's flak jacket over his blue sport coat. Digging that stuffed sausage look, Jared. Drama in the big house. Nunes out, you know, for the good of whatever. Carter Page, meanwhile, joyfully admits that he was a Russian agent. It was very, very exciting. Meanwhile, here in the Keystone State, many state Democrats joined Republicans in the PA House to vote to bring back mandatory minimums. Because that's been so good for our state so far. House GOP wants to cut fire services in Harrisburg, apparently to speed their plans to burn down the government. No movement yet on so-called right-to-work package in the state. That's a little bit of good news, I guess. There was, however, a rally in the Capitol coming out against that package. PASHE, the state system of higher education, moves its forward in its plans to gut public higher education in the state. On the positive side of the ledger, Philadelphia airport workers vote to unionize after a long struggle. PA Student Powers ramping up their fight. Students at Westchester University joined nationwide actions on Tuesday as part of a Fight for 15 and Fight Against Racism action on the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination. I want to remind everybody to tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Yours truly will be there giving the weekly resistance report. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. You can also tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, and with the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And if you missed the show, just go to the ricksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon in the sidebar. Remember, folks, now more than ever, we need you to help keep Pull No Punches progressive media going strong. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $2 a month. Just simply go to ragingchickenpress.org and look for that support and membership tab. You can become a member in two easy ways. You can just click become a member and you become a member through our Podbean site, or you can say become a patron and you become a member through Patreon. Not ready to become a member yet? No problem. You can make a one-time donation just by clicking donate. I have to say that this week, more than ever, it's just brought home how important it is to have independent voices and holding people in power accountable. As we move forward to enter into what just may be the fog of war, we're going to need some really kind of hard-nosed journalism to keep an eye on those people in power as they seek to kind of gut our public sphere and to gut everything that we hold dear. So that's my cheerful beginning of the day, Sean. How things out your end in Central PA?
They're going. It's a bit blustery and cold. The river is about like 5 feet from flood stage.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, that should do wonders for the sinkholes.
Actually, I think there's like a sinkhole forming around a house, like up the street from me.
Oh my God.
I don't know if it's a sinkhole, but there's a bunch of bricks that are caving in. And it's right next to a drainage pipe coming off the roof.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's bad.
That's so bad. Like, you see, like, this, like, hole, like, forming a little bit, and it's getting a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, like, but, like, one of the nice things that happened, since the weather is getting warmer, there is, like, a pothole that was maybe about, like, 3 feet deep. In the center of it, like a crater, like 3 feet deep, and it was like elongated, like 4 or 5 feet wide. It was in front of my apartment for 2 years.
Yeah.
They finally just cold patched it.
All right. Nice. Progress.
I hardly knew ye.
I
mean, I
barely had like, time. If only we had two more moments together.
I know, like every time I'd like pull out like of that parking spot over the past 2 years and just have like my front end go down and back up.
Oh God, man, that's crazy. Yeah, I needed that. So, man, I mean, this has been a crazy, 24 hours. I mean, we went from all eyes on what was going to happen to the Supreme Court this week. Then, of course, we have this absolutely horrific chemical weapons attack in Syria. The images, I don't think there's anybody out there who could say, look at these images and say that there's anything just less than horrific.
Unless you're Brian Williams.
What's that?
I said, unless you're Brian Williams.
Well, Brian Williams just liked to watch the, you know, the bombs go boom. So that's, I'm serious. He seemed like, it was like, he was talking about it like it was freaking fireworks.
Like it's Iraq 2002?
Basically, yeah. I mean, it was nuts, though. But, I mean, that was, I mean, absolutely, absolutely horrific attack on Tuesday. And then that, now you're going to, you know, now we're looking at the international stage. The question was, well, are we going to be going to war? What was going to be the response? And then in the midst of all that discussion, you have the Democrats kind of waging their first successful filibuster, losing only four of their members, who decided not to filibuster, proceeding with the filibuster, then the Senate going through and just bombing, no pun intended, the Senate rules to set the stage for Gorsuch to being approved today. And then last night, we get the bombing in Syria while Trump is meeting with, you know, the Chinese president planning on what to do with North Korea. What a freaking week.
And then Nunes steps down from the House Russian Intelligence Committee probe or whatever, while all this was happening yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. All this stuff is going on. Like, everyone's ramping up for that. And did you hear Paul Ryan's statement about that?
No, I did not.
Oh, my God. I mean, I don't know how that man lives with himself. I mean, he's basically saying, you know, Nunes has been like, you know, a trusted, you know, person on the intelligence committee, has my full trust. He still has my full trust. And he's been nothing but super ethical. I mean, it's like if Paul Ryan was Pinocchio, then we at very least then we could have an indication that he's lying, even though, you know, he's lying. You know, he's kind of telling half truth. But it was just kind of like going through what you would expect when someone steps down. You know, and I'm getting really, really nervous, and I have been this week about, moves to go forward and normalize once again, whether it's Paul Ryan just talking about, oh, yeah, this is just kind of run-of-the-mill procedure, and he doesn't want to distract from what's going on and what the agenda is. But in his statement, he makes a subtle shift, basically indicating that they want to shift the focus of that inquiry, right? Of that, and basically what they want to do is they want to focus on Russia's role in the elections. Meanwhile, the whole purpose of having the freaking investigation at the beginning was not to see what Russia did, right? That was part of it. It was to see if there was collusion between the Trump organization and the Russian government and Russian spies and Russian mobsters and all this other kind of stuff. So Ryan kind of subtly takes that off the table as part of that investigation. I mean, it was really crazy. I mean, and you just watch him like, oh my God, how's this man live with himself? You know, I just don't know.
It is amazing. One of the things, like, the same thing could be said about Pat Toomey. How does Pat Toomey live with himself after what he said yesterday? You know, we had to.
You got to talk about this. Yeah, go.
So I don't have the quote right in front of me, but basically he said we had to break, we had to preserve 200 years of tradition by gutting the filibuster, the Senate filibuster on a Supreme Court nominee because of a partisan opposition. When it was like, what, every Supreme Court nominee got the 2/3 majority or got that filibuster proof majority to vote for, to lead them forward.
Yeah, I, again, what happened, you know, you flick a switch between when Obama was in office and now when Trump is in office. And, you know, these people feel they can just kind of throw out the history and what they had been doing, right, to destroy the very institution that they're talking about. And now suddenly they're the guardians of the institution. I mean, it's disingenuous at the very best.
And one of the things where I think what led us to this road was the lack of resistance from Senate Democrats over the past year with Merrick Garland. You know, like, how come you didn't stage theater? You know, politics is mostly theater. How come you didn't have press conferences with Merrick Garland? Or how come you didn't have, like, hearings with just the Senate members of that committee? Like, call a Senate Democratic Caucus committee hearing and have Merrick Garland speak in front of you, ask serious questions, and push this narrative. Like, how come they didn't do that? Why? Because they probably thought Clinton was a shoo-in.
That's right. No, I think that's absolutely right, Sean. I think that is the only reason. And this is the other thing. You know, we talked now, about this. Well, go ahead. Sorry.
And now we're about to head back to what? The Lochner era? You know,
yeah.
1880s America.
Yeah. We gotta talk about that in a second. Let me just say this. And we gotta talk about that. What's at stake right now? But this is the other thing, just to go back to what you were mentioning there about what the Democrats should have done, right? Let's remember that after the election, right, after Trump won, right, Obama had the opportunity to do like a recess appointment of Merrick Garland, right? He had the opportunity to put him on the court, and he didn't do it. Now, I'll just say, if he did that, all holy hell would have broken loose in the Republican Party, right? They would have raised all sorts of ruckus and all this other kinds of stuff, but it would have forced the issue, right? And the very fact there would have had to be lawsuits in order to kind of remove him, that would have delayed any kind of future appointment for a long period of time, and eventually probably would have gone to the Supreme Court, which Merrick Garland would be sitting on at that point, right? So, I mean, that whole thing, Obama could have done that, right? But they didn't want to, for God knows why. God knows
the institutions.
What, because of some bizarre like refusal to recognize what's right in front of their faces and say that we're going to kind of go high, right? They went low, we're going high, right? I mean, that whole narrative begins to break down when people are playing a power game, not playing by institutional rules. And so why in God's name he didn't do that, I don't know, right? He didn't want his legacy tarnished. Well, guess what, Mr. Obama, right? You just tarnished our legacy, right? And, you know, again, I don't want to hate just on Obama because it was the strain all through the Democratic Party up until now. And now the Democratic Party are paying freaking catch up just trying to kind of see what it actually means to stage some resistance. And they're patting themselves on the back for this filibuster, right? But I don't believe for the life of me they know what the hell they're going to do next. Now they're going to have to come up with a new plan. Right.
And one of the things that I saw online from a couple of people was saying, you know, just vote for Gorsuch so you can preserve the filibuster. Well, guess what? The filibuster was going to go either way.
Exactly.
It was either going to be this Supreme Court justice or the next one that they pick. You know, like this filibuster was going to go away sooner or later. And you know what? You take that beating because now it just shows you one thing. The Republicans are trying to do everything they can up until the 2018 elections because they're worried they're going to lose one of the chambers and they're going to become powerless. That's what they're going to be doing.
Exactly.
They're going to be pushing everything and possibly they can down our throats. And the next 2 years, who knows what's going to happen.
Exactly. Exactly. And let's go to the point that you were making before, because this is how serious this is right now, is that we're talking about, when I say, you know, the repeal of the 20th century is now on the menu. Now that Gorsuch will be approved today, right? I don't say that lightly, right? Because what we have coming down the pike right now is that we have national, especially with now Trump and his organization in power, that we're going to have national right to work legislation that will be coming down the pike, which will seek to kind of gut collective bargaining rights across the country. We've seen this be marching state by state. We see what the plan does. We see what the results are. This is not a kind of, you know, some abstract move, right? We're going to know what's happening. We see what the legislation is going to look like, and this is what they're going to push. And the only thing that prevented it from going through last year when we had the Friedrichs case case that was before the Supreme Court was the death of Anton Scalia. Now that's not going to happen. Right. So here that's your number one. Number two, you're going to have got you already are seeing the attacks upon women. Right. You're already seeing about kind of the moves to try to kind of repeal vote against the Roe v. Wade decision to roll back protections for women's rights.
In Pennsylvania this week, we just had a bill introduced to completely defund Planned Parenthood in Pennsylvania. You know, like these aren't national, like the states aren't just doing these like on the whim, like these right. legislators in Pennsylvania or anywhere else around the country. They are doing this. These are national marching orders that are coming their way.
Oh, you can bet. You can bet about it. And I have to say, and I, you know, we talked about a little bit about this before we went on the air. I've been reading Jane Mayer's Dark Money, right? So it's like, what is it here? Dark Money, the hidden history behind the billionaires, behind the rise of the radical right. Right now, I bought this book a while ago, and after reading her kind of series of articles that was released, it was just fantastic, kind of charting some of this history. And as we've kind of known more about what's happened with the Koch, you know, the Koch brothers and their network with the ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, things like this. So I knew some of this history. We know that the SCAFE Foundation and the forget the guy's first name, but SCAFE comes out of Pittsburgh, right? Big kind of right-wing funder, but Koch brothers, a bunch of other folks like this. But I've been listening now to the book, when listening to the book on as I'm in my commute back and forth, and the depth of which these super wealthy few families have gone to since basically the New Deal, right? To basically return us back to that pre-New Deal era, the Lochner era, exactly as you said, has been systematic and frighteningly conscious, right? The whole idea about setting up the Cato Institute, setting up the Heritage Foundation, and setting up all these think tanks, and what they were trying to do with them, right? From our vantage point now, unless we're really in the weeds on this stuff, it just seems like, oh, there's more conservative think tanks out there and they're doing this stuff. This was a systematic kind of enactment of the Lewis Powell memo that we saw from, you know, 1971 or 73, I forget when it was put out, to basically systematically transform American democracy to bring us back to what they saw as the rightful path of America. And what's frightening about reading this book is that so much of the language that is basically just the common everyday language of Republicans today, right, was considered on the radical fringe back in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, right? But it was the language of this highly well, super wealthy, powerful group of families that kind of decided to invest in this stuff. And they've succeeded, right? I mean, they've succeeded in bringing us there. And I look at the state of here. I mean, we sit there and we come on air here, right? And on our website and everything like this, you basically have to beg, right, to get, you know, a few funders to come forward. Meanwhile, on the other side of things, they're given millions and millions of dollars, right, to invest in kind of, you know, the creation of a new intelligentsia. That's what they called it, a counter intelligentsia in the United States. And they're succeeding at it. And I really worried about it, Sean, that if whether or not we are going to be able to push back and roll back this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know it's not good. It's not good at all. But, you know, I think that, you know, in some ways, what's got me concerned right now, and especially about with the Supreme Court thing, I'll go back to what's happening in Syria, right? And the attacks are going on. There's also some reports that have been coming in this morning. I haven't seen this have been confirmed, although some of the websites have been reporting on this. I'm not so sure if they're actually reporting facts or if it's kind of has more to do with agendas. It's hard to parse some of the stuff out. But there was some early reports that following the U.S. airstrikes, there was an additional round of chemical attacks in Syria. I don't know if that's played itself out. Of course, Vladimir Putin has come out and he's basically, call the airstrikes illegal and all this other kind of stuff. And technically, you know, what we just did, what our country just did was not, you know, did not follow international law. Right. And it's even some questions about whether or not it followed our national law. But that's a whole other set of things on the agenda. But once we get into a kind of a war context, people start to change. And I just want to point something out. This just kind of like both infuriated me and scared me a little bit earlier. This was just yesterday, actually. This was in The Washington Post. It was written by Julie Pace from the AP. And it was, you know, basically ahead of Trump deciding whether or not to, you know, move forward with these attacks. And this is how she started out her piece. And it wasn't a strict reporting piece. Let me give you that. It was an analysis. But this is how she starts it off. Quote, say, for Donald Trump, the reality of the world's problems may be starting to sink in. Standing in the sunny White House Rose Garden, the president said Wednesday that the gruesome chemical weapons attack in Syria had changed his views in the quagmire of a conflict he'd previously indicated he wanted to steer clear of. He mourned the deaths of the youngest victims, quote, innocent children, innocent babies, and said brutality had crossed the line of crossed a lot of lines for me. It is now my responsibility, he declared. The president's words were far from the declaration he intends to act, and he notably avoided discussing a retaliatory thing, blah, 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 right? In that article, and there was like several other ones, I just didn't want to go through and read them all right now, where you start to see the language being placed about Trump starting to fill into the office, right? Starting to take these things seriously once again. And there, let me be clear, there's virtually no evidence that this is going on. Right. It is sheer conjecture. It is sheer projection on what people want this president to be. Right. And how they're supposed to act. We have no idea that like what's in his heart or what's in his mind. We just know that he's coming out. And we had these kinds of attacks. And yet the media, certain sectors of the media already seem to want to kind of normalize this and bring this into this kind of international conflict arena, which is going to be dangerous for what's happening nationally.
Yeah. Like it. No, these are one of those issues that this is scary what's happening in Syria, because Syria has been volatile for 6 years now. It's been a volatile place in the world for what we've done in that part of the world for the past, 20 years now, 30 years, pretty much. I know it's
no, it's just, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. And I think that's going to be the hardest thing, I think, for people to hold on to. There is not an easy narrative going forward here, right? I mean, what has been going on in Syria? I mean, if you actually
was this a change in his heart, or was this a deflection from what's been happening over the past week with Gorsuch and Russia?
Like I this is what I was saying to my wife last night. I said, I think it's as simple as this, right? He sees this attack, right? He feels that not responding to a brutal attack like this, it will make him look impotent. And so therefore he got pissed and he had to act. Right. And I think the only reason that we got, you know, whatever limited attacks this is, 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles, was because he actually consulted with some of the generals on the ground. Right. But, you know, again, there are agendas from those generals too, as well. Let's be clear, right? And Trump, who knows virtually nothing about any of this stuff, right, can be steered by people who have got agendas who are far better at this stuff than he is. So, I mean, we just don't know where it's going to go. And you know, people are going to want to fit this in a bunch of frames, right, that have already been established from previous conflicts, from previous presidents. But those frames don't mean anything at this point. They're people trying to fill up clothing that belongs to somebody else. So I think we're not going to know what's going to happen going forward. And I don't know if you saw this, but just this morning in Sweden, there was an attack, right? There was an attack of basically one of these kind of people got into a truck and ran into a group of people into a department store to run it down to as well. Again, there are no indications at this point. We don't know if that is a response somehow to what happened in Syria, or if that's an attempt. We don't know that. But the fact that Trump has kind of been talking about Sweden, right, as kind of the terrorist groups and everything, and it's been denied by the Swedish government, and now this happens, that's going to bolster further some of the worst tendencies within the Trump administration right now. So lots of stuff on the plate right now. And, you know, how we're going to balance this emergent kind of international kind of narrative that's going on to what's actually happening here locally is I don't know. It's going to be a challenge, Sean.
No, and this is the first big test of the Trump administration now.
No, exactly. Exactly. We don't know. And I think that, you know, at what's happening inside of it, I think, you know, if there's any, you know, less than sobering news, right? To kind of, you know, to find something to hold on to. I mean, at least, you know, the drama in the Trump administration is not exactly gone away. So nationally, I mean, I know if you've been following this week too as well, but you know, it's like the Bannon versus Jared kind of conflict that is apparently erupting. Bannon, of course, was out, like kicked out of the National Security Council. What those reasons are, we don't know exactly at this point, but it seems like there's like, you know, drama in the big house, you know, drama in the White House. It's like Jared seems to be kind of taking over more and more responsibilities. Bannon is kind of like, you know, calling Jared a cuck and a globalist behind his back, which of course might not be the worst insult in the world, you know, to every, the most people. But if you are on the far right, those are like the worst things you could say about people. Right. So
he's a little snowflake.
He's a little snowflake. Yeah. It's a little snowflake.
But no, like, the one of the things that like really catches me with this Kushner stuff that's been going on the past week, I think, what was it, Wednesday night, Maddo had a really good segment on her show about like how Russia, the nepotism,
yep,
and kleptocracy in Russia, that Putin had a $30 million rock gymnasium built for his daughter, one of his daughters or one of his family members, like in Moscow, while like instead of spending that on the public, like that. Just like highlighting the rank kleptocracy that like the scene in Russia, we're seeing the same thing here in the White House with Trump, yep, with Ivanka and Kushner. I mean, it's, I think Kushner scares me the most out of all of this.
How come?
What's his motives? Like,
yeah,
is
really
he
clear?
Yeah, like, is he going to be like a someone who's going to, what's like a historical character, I'm trying, the names are blanking me, like a Rommel or like that, like a.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. It's like, you know,
like someone that's pulling a dictator aside and making things much worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, and here's part of the thing. Again, this is kind of how my focus has been lately. I've been thinking about how ready, like, you know, especially the, you know, establishment Democrats, right, and even progressives that are, you know, whatever, how ready they are to have, they have this hope that like Ivanka is going to be the savior, right? We had that whole narrative about, you know, her being a, you know, you know, she was kind of putting the brakes on Trump. She was going to manage him a little bit. Her voice was going to be a moderating force within the White House and all this. And people want to love Ivanka and see her as this kind of heroine, right? And Jared, of course, was, you know, if you follow like the reporting on, especially the conflict between Bannon and Kushner, is that Jared was a liberal Democrat, right? Until his father-in-law ran for office, right? So, you know, there's this narrative set that like Ivanka, who's much more, you know, fashionable, right, and high scale and classy, married to this young boyish guy with good skin, right, and he's really a Democrat, and then they're actually going to have this kind of influence, right? It's almost as if we're seeing like, you know, the Charles and Princess Diana kind of narrative kind of being here. These are the ones that are actually going to save us. And that's, you know, like,
or no, I look at it like this. So the Lord of the Rings, right? The Two Towers, the mm-hmm. second one, the second movie, or the mm-hmm. second in the trilogy. Mm-hmm. You have the gut, like that evil figure that is pulling down the ear, like it's always like
a Wormtongue.
Is that was his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like Sauron's like minion, and he's like, you know, like influencing this king to do bad things. Like that's who I think. Like that's like Kushner in my opinion. Like this like evil side figure. Like exactly like Wormtongue from Lord of the Rings, and he's pulling Trump aside, and he's the influencer in this.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know enough about him to see if he's got that there or not. What, or I think, like, what my thought on it is like as simple as this: Trump is all. I mean, look at it through the mob lens, right? That's, again, I'll go back to that. Is that everything is about family and is about trust. Right. So you don't let people into your family that you do not trust. Right. And so and then because of that, once you have that trust with that person can trump. Right. Kind of any ideological position, because it's about keeping that, you know, core together. And Jared, right, for whatever reason, right, Trump trusts him. Right. And Jared has kind of shown obedience to Trump. And so I think it's as simple as that, right, is that Jared is going to tell things to Trump, and whatever Jared tells him, is going to be what moves it. That opens Jared. I mean, again, I don't know how smart the guy is. I don't know how much involved he is with policy, right? I mean, he has some experience, I guess. But it leaves it open for people to basically get Jared's ear, right, as a way to get to Trump, right? And I think that, you know, Jared's whole trip to Iraq, which he kind of like goes there and takes his flak jacket and throws it over his sport coat and looks like a stuffed sausage, right, which got a nice little traction on the net to, for a while. But when he does that, you've got these generals that are there kind of telling him kind of what's happening on the ground and all this other kind of stuff with their agendas. You know, I think that's the pipeline directly back to Trump through Jared.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, we'll see. We'll see how this plays out. I mean, Jared could. I mean, I don't see him necessarily as a worm tongue yet because I don't know if I can call him evil yet. I'm Bannon, sure.
That's what I thought Bannon was. Like, you know what I mean? But it doesn't seem like where's Bannon going from this? Is Bannon going to be kicked out?
That's a real good question. I mean, that's a real good question. And I'm not, you know, there's one narrative that it's about the fights between him and Jared, right? Apparently, Bannon was basically saying, had some arguments. He said, you know, reason why we fight all the time, Jared, is because you're a Democrat, right? Because you're a Democrat. We don't see eye to eye, right? So there's been some discussion about this as being this kind of ideological conflict within the White House, so within Trump's inner circle. And that might be true. But there's also some other things that are kind of going on, right? I mean, you know, is Bannon getting off the Security Council, right, as a way to go on the attack outside of the norms, right? Especially as this Russia thing comes up. There's been some suggestions. We saw this on the Majority Report. They were talking about Bannon has been following this Senate race, a special election in Georgia, very, very closely, and has shown some concern in that. Is he being pulled out of the Security Council so he can start getting back into the states just to shore up power? I don't know. You know, people who claim to know what's going on, I'm not settled yet on how accurate their claims are. As much as they, you know, these folks have shown that they will lie as a way to kind of deflect the attention away from what's really going on.
Yeah, it's there's just so much stuff that's going on right now. It's kind of ridiculous.
It really is. It really is. Well, it's like, you know, especially at the national level, the one thing we have, if you have the counterbalance, you have the counterexample of what you see with Kushner and Bannon, at the very least, we could say that Carter Page is not cut from the same cloth.
I was going to say, I thought we were going to like gloss over this segment without talking about Carter Page.
How can we not talk about Carter Page, man? That was crazy.
Like, what was he like thinking when he's on, like, on the radio, like doing these interviews, right? He knew he was a Russian spy or an operative, at least unwitting operative, right? I guess is how they put it.
Right, right, right.
But like, he's given these like interviews on TV, like these strange friggin' interviews, like saying, man, I am so screwed right now. Like,
right.
Like, but like, how, if you're caught up in a spy ring, right? How does your campaign not figure that out?
Well, I mean, because
or they just gloss dumb. Over it.
Right. I mean, like, isn't that really what it comes down to?
Either they're that dumb or they're that just like not giving a crap.
Well, what just, you know, look, I think that once you're in the world of, you know, you're going to make deals in order to kind of get money regardless of what it is, and then you seem to have opportunities, that's what kind of matters, right? And what was remarkable, like Allie Watkins, who, you know, the reporter from BuzzFeed who broke this story, that it was actually Carter Page was the, you know, the person that was it CIA or was it the... was the Homeland Security, it was part of you looking at, maybe it was FBI, kind of when they broke that Russian spy ring, and there's this person referred to as Mail One, right? And Allie Watkins basically was able to kind of figure out who it was, and it was Carter Page and some people who kind of said this. So she calls them up and says, you know, hey, so there's this transcript out there saying that you were one of the people that were brought on to be, you know, nurtured for being a Russian agent, right, as your Mail One. Are you Mail One? He's like, oh, yeah, geez, that was me. Oh, can you believe such a thing? Oh, I didn't even know. I was just sitting there trying to get oil money and stuff. And, oh, They have spies. You know,
like, two guys with a funny Brooklyn accent came up to me and started talking to me. I never heard that type of New York accent before.
Right, I was just going to Coney Island for some borscht. I didn't know that these guys were Russian agents. Right, he was like, can you imagine being the reporter on the other end of that call? Right, being like, did he just say that? Yeah, that's me. Did he actually say that?
Right, you know, that closes that situation.
Well, because I mean, you know how this goes, right? I mean, you sit there if you're going to interview somebody and you basically know the answer to the questions, right? So you know that this guy in this case, right, was male one. You've had enough sources confirm it. None of them are going to go on the record and things like that. But you got enough background information that you're about 95% sure. So what you're going to try to do is you're going to question him to do your due diligence, right? But your full expectation is that he's going to deny it or try to skirt it or something, right? So you've got your questions lined up that you're going to ask him to put increasing pressure on this person to kind of like say, no, look, this is what I know. But so you get all geared up, you make the call, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's me. Well, look, I got a T-shirt, male one.
You know, it's like, oh, well, that settles that then.
Oh, my God. I know. It's like, well, okay, I guess I got a little extra hour to write my story now, you know. But it's like, I mean, it was incredible. I mean, that this guy, especially – after he, like you said, he'd given all these weird, weird television interviews where he said that he knew Trump, but then he doesn't know Trump, and maybe he met him and didn't. Like the interview with Chris Hayes. What's that?
He doesn't know who Kislyak is, never met with the ambassador of Russia, never went to Moscow.
Oh, Moscow? No, no, wait, is that in Russia?
That's Goldberg.
I'm in Russia. You know, it's like, what? It's like, oh my God, it's just crazy. So at least there's that. I mean, you know, if the entertainment value at least hasn't gone away, you know, if you're, you know, kind of enjoy watching the world burn. I mean, it's what we're watching right now. So crazy. So listen, we're going to wrap up this first part here. We're just going to have to. And we had to talk about what's going on in Syria. Obviously, that's going on. There's big stuff happening in the Supreme Court. A lot of this stuff, you know, look, it's just going to get, it's a lot of what's been going on, what we've been paying attention to, is going to get buried by this Syria stuff right now. Not that the Syria stuff is not important, let me be clear. But I just from what I've been seeing in the media right now, they feel a heck of a lot more comfortable covering the stories in this international arena than they have covering the stuff that's happening on the ground nationally. So it's going to play itself out, and we're going to try to follow as best we can. So when we come back, we're going to kind of turn inward a little bit here and take a look at things going on here in the Keystone State. We do have some good news, right? It's as usual, it's a little bit limited. but you know, let's not forget that there are movements going on, and I've been waiting. I've been kind of keep on refreshing my pages here too, as well, to see if there is going to be any kind of response from some mass movements to any potential further conflict. So we'll keep an eye on that. Anyways, when we come back, we'll take a look at what's happened here in PA. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. Their slogan was Justice for Janitors. Their chant was Si Se Puede, Yes We Can. Their image was a red and black poster of a mop raised high in a clenched fist. 3,000 members of SEIU Local 1877 marched in the streets of downtown Los Angeles. Many of the marchers were Latina women. Some had their children with them. On this day in labor history, the year was 2000. The massive protest marked the third day of their strike for a better life. The janitors were some of the poorest paid workers in Los Angeles. Their average wage was only $6.70 an hour. This was well below the janitorial wage of most other major cities in the U.S. Picketing workers targeted downtown office buildings. 18 contractors oversaw the janitorial services in these buildings. The workers demanded $1 an hour wage increase for 3 years. The contractors refused to negotiate. Several prominent politicians and religious leaders supported the strike. Finally, after 3 weeks, the strike was settled. The union won a 25% wage increase over 3 years. Although it was a sizable victory, it fell short of the hoped goal for $3 an hour. Jose Chayas, a shop steward and member of the negotiating committee, explained, "Even as united as we were, every nickel was difficult." The fight in Los Angeles was just one battle in the long Justice for Janitors struggle. Since 1985, SEIU has been working on the janitors' campaign, which includes nearly a quarter of a million workers. In the next 2 years, 130,000 janitors in 33 cities across the nation will negotiate their contracts. Very likely, this will include janitors in a city near you. Will you support their fight for justice? Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. So, Sean, as bad as things are going nationally and things like this, there's some, there is some good news here in Pennsylvania. I mean, you know, I don't want to forget that we still have a kind of actions weekly with the Tuesday with Toomey folks. There's some great activism that's going on. There's still people that are plugging away. They're looking for running in primaries to kind of basically take back their local Democratic parties or to take them, just to take them. Forget about take back. We're going to take them and through kind of, local activism. So there's really good stuff going on. Resist Doylestown, for example, has been conducting meetings and kind of planning the next series of actions. We've got a whole series of events coming down the pike. So, for example, we've got the kind of the tax day protest, right, where you have in D.C. where people are kind of gathering to demand that Donald Trump produces his taxes. We've got the March for Science coming up on April 22nd, which is going to be happening in Washington, D.C. and cities around the country, basically demand that we have policy that is informed by science, especially after we've seen unprecedented attacks on science through the by the Trump organization since he's taken office. And then we've got a week later, April 29th, we've got the People's Climate March, which once again is happening in D.C. and cities around the country. So the movement hasn't gone away, even in the face of this kind of this dire stuff that we're seeing.
Yeah, can I plug something real quick?
Yeah,
don't know if I talked to you about this that much, but I am actually helping plan a rally out here in Harrisburg on Sunday, April 23rd on the Capitol steps at 4 p.m. We are going to be having a rally about like the environment post Earth Day thing. We're going to be protesting. It's going to be called Save Our Susquehanna. It's going to be talking about the proposed budget cuts, the EPA cuts to the Chesapeake Bay program and other issues with the Susquehanna River. But also this is going to be an environmental justice vigil and rally. You know, we're going to be focusing on how these cuts also intersect race, class, and poverty. And we're going to be talking about a whole lot about environmental justice and how, you know, these issues affect your rural white farmers as they do to your single mothers living inside some of these cities. The drinking water for up to 10.7 million people would be at risk if 30% budget cuts go through. And this issue, this rally is going to be calling out those issues and how it relates as a class and poverty issue.
That's awesome, man. We need some major, major pushback on the score, especially after, you know, we found out just like, you know, a week ago or so that, you're up against God on this one, right? I mean, since God has been shown to be one of the primary polluters of the...
That's if you, I'm sorry to offend some people out there, but that's if you believe in God.
Well, that's true, but still, I mean, you know, it's still a formidable presence, right?
So yeah, I always said if I ever got elected, always think if I ever get elected to office, especially like the House, I would have a copy of Darwin's, book on evolution, Origin of Species, just sitting right there on the House floor.
Yeah, it'd be good. You could take your oath of office on the Origin of Species. How's that?
No, but I mean. That would really inflame a lot of people.
Yeah, that'd be funny. But that was Scott Perry, right? That was Scott Perry that was saying that?
Yeah, Scott Perry.
Last week,
also, we're moving closer to the sun.
moving. Oh my God, we are moving closer to the sun. So just to, for those of you,
let me just say this: the fallout from this with Scott Wagner. No one has really touched on this in the media, but in multiple accounts, Wagner's campaign aide Jason High said, "You know, Wagner believes there are many forms of climate change."
There's many forms of climate change.
So, like, no one's really talked about this yet, but you're still beating around the same bush. You're just a climate denier.
Right. They're just trying out new slogans, right, to see which one maybe work out better than the last one. So that's good. No, so for those folks, if you didn't catch our show last week before, it's like, this is basically Scott Perry basically said, you know, that EPA regulations God are pollutes. Bad. And right, exactly. And that, you know, some of the pollution that's causing the Chesapeake Bay is, you know, caused by God, right? You know, and so what's this against God? And it was just like, the insanity was just really off the hook. So, you know, if you missed that episode, go back and check it out, because it was pretty nuts. But great. So, but we do have some other good news here that's recent. I mean, so we had just on Tuesday, airport workers at Philadelphia International Airport just voted overwhelmingly to join SEIU Local 32BJ down in Philadelphia.
And this is a five-year campaign.
Exactly, right? This is almost five-year campaign they've been working on this. And the vote, when I say overwhelming, it was 406-58, right? I mean, that is not like, you know, barely passing here. This is a huge victory, and kudos to the organizers and the workers who have basically stayed with this campaign over this past 5 years. And if you remember, I mean, they had some major protests, right? They had huge rallies on the tarmac and around the airport. It was absolutely
incredible. They threatened to go on strike during the DNC.
They threatened to go on strike before the DNC, right? And that went right up to the wire, right? You remember that? That was incredible. And also, you know, we should say that this wasn't their first victory, because as part of their push for years ago, I mean, part of what they did is they won an agreement from the city, right, to be paid $12 an hour, keeping with living wage standard approved by Philadelphia voters in May 2014, right? Because before that, they were paid as little as $7.75 an hour to work at the airport, and they put their, you know, direct action pressure on city council and to the city to get that initial raise. Right now, they went follow that up, say, well, the raise isn't enough. We're not just going to have like
a contract.
Money. Exactly, we want a contract and we want a union, and that's what they've got. And that was a reminder. This comes on the heels of this is a huge victory. This took place on Tuesday night. Tuesday night was also the national Fight for 15 actions that basically joined the Black Lives Matter movement and the kind of Fight for 15 movement together, fighting for racial justice and economic justice, calling to mind it was on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, who had been in Memphis working with sanitation workers on just exactly those issues when he was assassinated in 1968. And so for that vote to take place on that day as part of the day, the same kind of national campaign after a long struggle to get here, is a significant achievement. So kudos to those folks down there in Philadelphia. It underscores the kind of momentum that organizing is having nationwide right now.
Yeah, no, it shows you that this is a long game, especially with what happened in the Philadelphia airport workers. I mean, I think haven't been following us on the website, but it's something we've been following, you know, keeping an ear on locally over the past 5 years, especially with the actions that they've been doing. You know, you knew that they were in a contract battle or a struggle to join a union, but like it you just knew it was always going on. And finally they came ahead to a victory on Tuesday night. And I didn't realize it was been going on for 5 years now.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm telling you. And it seems like, I think you wrote something about this on Raging Chicken back in the day.
Maybe, possibly.
Yeah, I was going to plug it up and see if it was if it came up, but I, you know, because you were following a lot of stuff that was happening with I think this was even before you moved out to Harrisburg, following stuff that was happening down in Philadelphia with workers, and especially with SEIU 32BJ, because they were doing so much amazing direct action, especially with the Fight for 15 and so on. So, you know, pretty cool. So that's the other thing. The other thing I should definitely kind of point out too, as well, we've been following this here at Raging Chicken Press. We've been talking about here on the podcast too, as well. That last semester, the fall semester, fall 2016 semester, ABSCUF, the faculty union that represents all the faculty, I'm a member of that faculty at the 14 state-owned universities in Pennsylvania. We went on strike for the first time in our history for a three-day strike that we were able to hold a line on everything. We basically won everything that we were looking for. But so much of that strike depended upon the solidarity work of students. And those students have gone on now to form their own organization statewide called PA Student Power Network. And they're kind of establishing chapters and locals on each one of the Poshi campuses, but other campuses too as well, both public and private or state or state-related universities as well as some private universities where this network is expanding and students are kind of acting. So also as part of the Fight for 15 Day on Tuesday, the PA Student Power Network local chapter at Westchester University, they had just an absolute raucous march. And they, of course, have kind of launched a campaign for $15 minimum wage on campus, right? Plus a freeze in tuition. Those are those kind of their two demands at this point. They had a rally when they first launched this a couple of weeks back, but on Tuesday, they basically took the fight directly to the president of the university. They have been trying to get meetings with administrators, and they've been kind of rebuffed. So basically, after a rally in support of the $15 minimum wage and a freeze on tuition on campus, they marched to the administration building, and they demanded to see the president or get an appointment with the president. They were met by some university officials, and those students refused to leave that building until they got a commitment for a meeting from the president. I believe they got that meeting for April 11th, if I've got that date right. Again, you see the kind of student activism happening on local campuses. And this is the kind of thing I think is important for everybody to keep in mind, right, is that when we're talking about political action, right, having kind of political action and organizing in defined locations like your workplace, right, is super, super important. Too often, I think progressives start to think about political action just on this national score or this abstract policy discussions, right? Those are, of course, important. I don't mean to kind of minimize that, but where you're talking about building power, right, you're talking about building power in communities, in workplaces, right? And that's where you can begin to exercise those power and gain the practice in self-rule, gain practice in worker, you know, worker democracy, basically, is what we're talking about. Taking over our communities and acting in the best interest of our communities. This is really, really, really important work that's going on. So kudos to those folks as well.
Yeah. And the stuff that the student Pennsylvania Student Power has been doing over the past, you know, a few months, they've been getting a lot of good news play lately, especially yes. with the stuff going on with the immigration bills that have been going through the state legislature. You know, it's encouraging to see an actual statewide student movement on Apache campuses, because, you know, I haven't really seen anything like that. When I was at school, I don't know if you've seen anything like this well organized or this across so many campuses, other than like your issues around the budget, you know, which are usually just like one or two rallies.
Right. No, I guess the difference now is that they have an organization. They're consciously kind of building an organization. They're not just coming out for a particular issue or a particular rally, right? That's really important. And that's what kind of sets this apart from others. You know, one thing I remember years ago, this is like, you know, because I've worked with students before, I worked with student organizations before at Kutztown University's campus. But it's always been, you know, up and down. If anybody's ever done student organizing, I was a student organizer when I was a student, right? Is that you've got the, you know, the ups and downs of student organization because, you know, people graduate, right? And there's always that need to kind of re-educate and rebuild movements. And what everyone's needed, right? I think students have recognized this, but haven't really had, I think, that push, that focus, right, to think about the, you know, organizing all together. And part of that come, you know, we've got James Sersonsky, who's been working with students to kind of help do some kind of training on this. A bunch of those students were at the Labor Notes conference a couple of weeks back that I was at, getting additional training and organizing. They're thinking about building this sustainable, because that's really kind of what it's after, and that's what's different. And I think that, you know, you've seen the assault on public higher education, the cuts in higher education. You've seen increased tuition, reduction in job prospects for students who are graduating. I think a lot of stuff came together to basically for students to be able to say, hey, look, you know, we need to do this now. And, you know, and I think they cut their teeth a little bit, basically being part of the faculty strike. They were amazing organizers. They were kind of amazing, going to be out on the line. And I think they wanted to continue that and started asking that question. You know, once again, now, how do we do this, right? How do we do this for ourselves and move forward? So you're absolutely right. I mean, they're showing up in the Capitol, they're showing up in their legislators' offices, and they're showing up on their campuses to build more power. It's awesome stuff. Right. So crazy. So, and I'll have to say, you know, I should say, I use that as a way of kind of a segue into the bad stuff in some ways, but, you know, I think right now is going to be the biggest challenge that that movement is going to face. And frankly, for ABSCUF too, as well, because last Friday, Friday night, and I covered this for Raging Chicken, five Pasha universities basically issued the not quite yet letters of retrenchment, right? This is a notification of the possibilities of retrenchment, right? So California University, Cheney University, Edinburgh University, Mansfield University, and Clarion all were notified by their administrations to kind of basically brace themselves for cuts. that's what it was limited to. At the same time that that is going on in terms of those, the pushes for retrenchment, these are some of the same universities that faced the worst cuts during the last time we retrenched a few years back. But the Pasha University, under the direction of the Chancellor Brogan, basically hired an outside consultant to go around and basically look at kind of remaking the universities. And so they're already making their rounds. They basically are going to be showing up at Kutztown University, where I work, on the 20th, to ask questions of faculty members and students and so on. And we'll see what happens, because they will use this. I, you know, mark my words, they're going to use this as a way to accomplish what they couldn't get in their contract fights. They're going to, I would bet that they're going to move to try to close some of the universities or to merge them with other universities, as well as eliminate some significant programs and remake a lot of what's happening in academics at these universities. You know, because like any consultant, right, they're given their marching orders by the people who hire them, and that's the chancellor, and that's what he said he wants to do. So that's, you know, coming down the pike. Yep.
You know, it's one of the things I wonder. I wonder how the representatives or senators representing universities like Mansfield or Lock Haven, you know, or some of these smaller universities in the Pasha system feel when the state system of higher education, basically a bureaucrat, right? It's all in a government appointed bureaucrat. And Brogan is thinking about shutting down the economic powerhouse of that region.
Well, you know, that's
like imagine the hundreds or thousands of jobs that would be lost, you know, the thousands of jobs lost if a Mansfield closed, and like what that would do to the local economy, you know, your tax base and everything else.
You're absolutely right.
Like, I wonder if you're a conservative Republican in that district, I wonder what your constituents are feeling. You're going to allow this guy to take away our largest source of income? Are you kidding me?
No, but Sean, frankly, that's the reason why that you've seen actually some Republicans, even some ones on the more conservative side of things, when it comes to, you know, protecting those universities, they've you know, not all 100% of the time, but on several times have basically come out to help defend the universities precisely for that reason. It has nothing to do, you know, they might be ideologically opposed to anything public, but that when it comes to, you know, their own hides and kind of getting reelected and recognizing that if that university is, say, Mansfield or Clarion or, you know, even Cheney for that matter, shut down, that's going to have a significant impact. I'm sorry, what?
I might lose my job as a representative.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, and at the end of the day, this is one of those things that they care about.
I mean, these are parts of the state where the coal industry is gone and not coming back. You know, the Marcellus shale industry is there, but that money's not staying within the community because it's all out of state people working out here. You know, it's like, you know, you just like, you know, this is like your like factory pretty much. You're gonna allow your like factory to shut down and leave.
Well, no, exactly. And, you know, it's, and I, in those same areas where you've had, You know, extractive industries or kind of steel industries, that kind of stuff, where those things have all shut down. You hear the mantra about, well, then you have to go out back and get an education. So you've got to retrain yourself and so on. So, well, where the heck are you going to do that, right? If you're going to shut down all those universities. And, you know, you guys should go to your for-profit online centers and kind of get ripped off and go further into debt. I guess that's their plan. But we'll see. But, you know, what's happening, though, too, as well, is that in addition to the attempts to kind of, you know, further gut these programs, the ones that I mentioned explicitly, those universities explicitly, what's happening on other campuses, Kutztown being one of them, is that they're basically taking full-time temporary positions, which were relatively stable jobs, which were relatively consistent and well-paid, right, on scale with, you know, first-year tenure track lines. Certainly not ideal, right? But, you know, has been called the gold standard nationwide. What they've been doing is turning those full-time positions into part-time positions, right? So in my department alone, for example, we went from having, I think, 7 full-time temporary faculty members, right, in the department to cutting a total, to basically turning that from 7 into 6, but only 3 of those being full-time, another 3 of them being part-time, right? So the squeeze is on, and that's happening in departments across the entire state. A course that I helped develop or help was part of actually in the early stages of, I should say, didn't help develop it. It was early stages of when it started acting. Was a course called English 022, designed to help at-risk students, right, get extra practice in writing and so on, and so on. They just eliminated that last week, right? So those students that are most at risk and most in need of these kind of courses, and this, again, I should be clear, is not a remedial class. This is a class those students want additional practice in writing. That course has been eliminated, again, sending those students out to dry. You know, that's happening like under the radar, in addition to the kind of overt retrenchments moving forward. So it does not look good for what's happening in higher education. And basically the only thing that will change that is going to be movements across the state to put pressure upon politicians to fund public education. That's it. Right. It's like they can want to, like, we have been cut to the bone, right, as it stands so far. And you've even had some university presidents say this the last time of retrenchment, basically throwing their hands up in the air and say there's nothing more to cut. Right. What we can't do anymore. But that's where we're at, Sean. And this is a decision that I think is staring in the face of both faculty and students right now about how are they going to choose to fight back against this yet another more austerity measures and more cuts happening statewide. It's nuts. But I don't know what to say. I don't. But speaking of cuts, though, you also mentioned the other thing that I think we should highlight here, too, as well. It might be a little harder to, you know, prevent your house from getting burned down there in Harrisburg. Is that correct?
Yeah. So over the past about month, there's been 3 or 4 like high profile fires in Harrisburg alone. You know, regionally, they've gotten a lot of media coverage. And Harrisburg has a full-time fire department, right? The only other full-time fire departments in this area is going to be the naval base in Mechanicsburg across the river on the West Shore, mm-hmm. right? So there's only like 2 full-time. There might be a couple like more, but most of the fire companies around here, they're going to be outside of Harrisburg and outside of the naval base, are going to be volunteer fire services, right? They have very low operating budgets. Our fire department staffed with full-time fire workers, and every year the state funds the Harrisburg Fire Department $5 million in lieu of providing protection to the 40 or 50 some odd state buildings within the city, right? Mm-hmm. The state already does not pay taxes on any of the buildings that they own, and they own about 1/4 of the land in Harrisburg. So there's very little money coming into Harrisburg from the state, even though the state occupies all this land, right?
Right, right.
And now what the state is proposing to do, at least the House Republicans are, is to cut the $5 million that they give every year to the Harrisburg Fire Department out of the budget for protecting these buildings, right? The state-owned buildings. And basically, this would mean that the fire department in Harrisburg would get cut. You know, there's jobs here that people obviously, that there's not fires at the state buildings every day. A lot of the fires are going to be in the residential thing, but because you have that $5 million there as a guarantee, that allows you to fund and keep more jobs on. So they are now, the Pennsylvania Republicans are trying to eliminate services to gut residential fire services in the city of Harrisburg.
Man, I'm telling you, just kind of backwards thinking. Right. I mean, what else can we say? So, we're gonna have to close out with just something that just makes your head hurt. Right. So you were telling me a little bit about this earlier on today, that we've get some movement on some really important bills in the House. Right.
Yeah. Something really important, like restoring mandatory minimums. So another budget math. Right. So we'll get into the meat of this. This bill would cost, if we're to become, an extra $50 million a year out of the Department of Corrections budget, right? So what did the Republicans do while they're pushing this bill forward in the House?
Do tell.
They voted to reduce the corrections funding by $95 million.
Brilliant.
And 13 Democrats from this district, or no, 13 Democrats from around the state voted for this bill. You know, and most of them come from our Hold Them Accountable page. So, you know,
let's echo that, everybody. 13 Democrats, right, voting basically to throw more people in jail, right, just occurred. Again, Democrats, folks.
And only one of them was from the southeastern part of the state, which the southeastern delegation put a press release out the other day saying that they were all going to vote for it, against it, besides one member, and that member is Tina Davis out of Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
I'm just going to take a little drive one of these days down to see her then.
So just imagine how white these districts are, you know, out in western PA and out in northeastern PA.
Right. You know, and what's again astonishing about this is this comes in the face of growing evidence, and even at the national level, to some degree, some bipartisan evidence some of these things are not the best practice, right? They're showing that basically what you're doing is you're finding ways of, you know, basically kicking primarily poor people and people of color off the voting rolls, right? Especially if you have, like, you're busted for pot and that's a felony, then try to kick them off, right? Or if you're kind of just want to give them a record and make their lives even that much more precarious, right? All under this kind of, like, you know, punishment regime, you know, just kind of,
and then also
law and order garbage that's coming out of the national level too.
And then also, if you try to shut down some of these prisons, a various coalition of labor representatives, like labor organization that represents these groups, and these Democrats actually fought to keep like three or four of these jails open once Wolf proposed to cut them. Because, you know, like, I am all for closing our corrections facilities. I see that as a progressive budget solution. You know, like decriminalizing marijuana, progressive budget solution, because it's not tying up the courts, it's not tying up the judicial system. Cops and people and law enforcement officers are going to be able to do your jobs. You know, you're not, you know, you get rid of the bail system and stuff like that, which is being proposed in Philadelphia. But, like, you do have people that are beholden to groups that represent these workers, you know, to keep these prisons open, which is, like, some of the issues that we find within the progressive realm.
No, that's right. I mean, it's like, you know, again, you said, you know, I always think about the same kind of garbage that we get, right? We get this kind of stuff where we have about prisons, right? And we get this stuff about pipelines, right? We get these kind of the short version of this. And this is the kind of thing the labor movement is just going to have to suck it up and go long term if you're going to have any power long term. Enough of this kind of, like, you know, I'm going to
protect. We got to keep the prisons open.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like, look, like my cousin, you know, worked as a correction officer for years time. And thank God for the union, right? I mean, I'm telling you, his life would have been that much more precarious and worse if he had not had that union, right? So all the more reason that they should be unionized. I'm all for it, right? That's fine, right? Same kind of stuff. I want union workers. If there's got to be a pipeline that's going to be built, right? There's no other way around it. I want someone on the job who's going to be able to have rights to basically say that something's going wrong, right?
Or has that skill, that trade.
Exactly, right? I want the best qualified people that are going to be on there, and I want people that are not going to be afraid that they're under the thumb of some big corporation. That's what I want, right? However, I also don't want pipelines to begin with, right? I want to shut down the fracking stuff right now. I think that Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, lays it all out about why this kind of like this the growth of the prison industrial complex has done nothing, right, but send us back into a new Jim Crow, right? And it has multiple implications economically, in terms of political participation right across the board, and furthers the kind of racial injustice that we see kind of like in the entire long history of the U.S. And frankly, you know, this is where I think from my perspective, this is where some of the strongest voices from labor, from the people who actually the activists are organizing on the ground that have a long-term solution, need to get back to that movement building. It cannot just be about protecting our jobs right now, because we're going to lose, man. We're going to lose. Until we have the idea that we're about gaining power, not simply protecting our jobs. We're going to lose. We're going to lose. We're going to lose. Look what happened with the Keystone XL pipeline. The folks that got behind that pipeline and said, no, we're going to do this because of jobs. How many jobs is it going to produce in the long run? 35. 35 jobs that are long-term. Yes, there's going to be some short-term work, but then the 35 jobs long-term. That is not a jobs plan for the United States of America. That is not something that's going to be sustainable, and it's going to send our communities, those of us who are most precarious, right, it's going to send us down the toilet when it comes to climate change and further industrial pollution. This is not a good pattern. So, you know, again, I mean, this is these folks, these Western Democrats who want to kind of see themselves as whatever law and order people, or kind of want to get behind kind of the most conservative ends of the labor movement, right? Dude, you're fighting a losing battle and you're taking us down with it. It's got to stop.
Yeah.
I have an opinion about that, Sean. So this bill that went through, so you got the House goes through, the Senate still got to vote on it though, right?
Correct.
So when's that going to happen, you know?
I'm not sure. Probably next week, or I know the ACLU is trying to stop it. One good thing is there are not enough votes in the House for a veto override. So if it gets to the governor's desk, hopefully he will veto it.
Do you think he will veto it, though?
I don't know. Hopefully he does.
I mean, you look at this. It's right. This is going in. I mean, we're going to start getting close to where he's going to have to start thinking about his reelection campaign, right? And, you know, if he's going to – is he actually going to kind of, you know – turn his back on this kind of thing too as well, because it's, you know, would look bad for his kind of law and order kind of creds or something like this. I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see though.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. And this is definitely going to be a fight. The other thing too, as well, we should say that we mentioned this last week. We thought there might be some movement on it this week. It turns out there's not. If you recall that the GOP, the state GOP, put together a package of 7 bills, the right to work legislation, that would have just been some of the worst kind of right to work initiatives in the nation. But there, if I'm right about this, right, Sean, there has not been movement on that.
That's correct.
Okay. We'll continue to follow that one. I just wanted to touch on that since we said we were going to come back to it this week. And I know people have been asking a little bit about us. The other thing I should say before we go to our last break, they just confirmed Gorsuch. It just came up on the news. So sure enough, the war on the 20th century has officially begun, folks. So anyways, when we come back, we're going to look for some sort of silver linings and whatever clouds that we can find. Don't have any good space stories today, but I do have a couple good beers recommendations. So we'll go to that. We'll be back right after this. This is Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. We'll be right back.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism, and frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight.
Well, Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. So, Sean, got any good news for us? Silver linings for the end of the week?
There's a bunch of Bourbon Barrel Sunny Side Up left at Pizza Boy.
You hear that, everybody?
Cans.
Woof. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
It's really good. I've already had a couple cans.
And Sean has told me, he's going to front me this stuff. I'm going to give him a little extra, and he's going to bring me a little six pack when he comes home for Easter. So I'm totally freaking psyched about that. And I'll also be able to give him the little gift I gave him, got for him out there in Oregon when I was out in Portland a couple weeks back. So that's good. Any other news and blues for the good of the order?
No, nothing really. Nothing really is going on.
Nothing really?
No.
Nah, sounds good.
It's going to be in the 80s next week, so I'm going to look forward to get some hiking in next week.
That's so good. I got to say, Harrisburg is a beautiful area for hiking too.
Yeah, I've been taking my camera out lately, and I'm going to do some take some nice pictures up. But like either Hawk Rock, which overlooks the Susquehanna and Juniata Rivers, mm-hmm. Off the Appalachian Trail, or going down to Pine Grove Furnace, mm-hmm. which is out near Shippensburg.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, I got a couple quick recommendations for folks that are going to pick up here. One is the Weyerbacher's Sin Sanity. That's like sin as in cinnamon. It's a barley wine ale aged in bourbon barrels with cinnamon, and not just a tad of cinnamon. It's got nice, like, lots of cinnamon in it. So it's got that strong cinnamon taste going for it, and it comes in like 13%, right? So I was like, holy cow. But it is really, really good. They put out some really great stuff. I mean, I've actually like Weyerbacher, like their stuff, and I've been really liking some of the bourbon barrel stuff they've been doing recently. And the other one, if people want to try something a little bit different, this is my thing. Again, I'm looking for happy stuff today, folks. So I picked this one up because I'm like, you know what? I need something happy. And this is the thing, like, it's part of the Blackwater series from Southern Tier. It's called Thick Mint, right? As opposed to Thin Mint, because really it does taste like a Girl Scout cookie, right? But it is, they call it a dessert beer, and it's brewed with chocolate and mint. So if you're looking for something that's kind of a little sweet and happy, go check it out, folks. You know, it's like, got to do the little things that'll keep you going. I might even be doing a little day drinking here in a second, but we'll see, because it's been a bad day. All right, man. So I guess we'll try to hold on to the rails and keep the ship straight between now and next week, huh?
Yeah, we got to.
All right, man, keep it up. And listen, folks, I want to, you know, the last thing I want to say is, like, you know, think about it. If you got stuff that you think we should be paying attention to, you got actions that are coming up, if you got a report that you want to get in, or you got just some commentary that we say, you know, shoot us a line to ragingchickenpress@gmail.com. It's probably the best way to kind of get to us. We think we're probably going to have a comment line that's going to come up at some point. But for right now, like, you know, you got ideas, you got comments, you got things to say, shoot us a note. You can also comment. If you go up on Podbean, you go check our stuff on Podbean. There's places where you can comment. Kind of below each episode, if you got things to say, and we'll kind of get back to you on that. Just be kind of really good to hear back from people right now. I think it's important that we have, you know, these kind of opportunities to kind of stay in touch, even if it's virtually. So thank you all for listening. Thank you all out there who have been supporters over the years. And for those folks, especially those folks who are supporting members of the show. All right. And once again, as a reminder, if you can afford it, if you can find it in yourself, right, to support, like, pull no punches, aggressive, progressive media, right? Go to our support and membership tab at ragingchickenpress.org, right? And become a member for as little as $2 a month. And, you know, coming at the $5 a month level, that's even better. It'd be super. All right. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're signing off. Go off into the day. We'll talk to you next week. See ya.